So, the Maharahulavada Sutta, Majjhima 62. And following on a little theme it, following on from the last sutta to Rahula, and now this one is it's like a more developed version, more advanced teachings. Rahul has presumably grown up a little bit, and now he's getting some of the more hardcore teachings compared with last time. So. So here's the Chinese version. Those who can read Chinese. Okay, only one Chinese version for this one, and that's found in the Ekhotara Agama. And during the class, as always, we'll be referring to these studies by Venerable Nalaya to give us some information about the relationship between the Pali and the Chinese version. So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove and Anathapindika's Park. And when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Savatthi for alms. So, you see, the outer robe, of course, is the Sankhati. And this is kind of the standard passage where they... Oh, sorry, it doesn't actually say. It's in the Satipatthana Sutra. It says Sankhati Patta Jivara. It says taking the bowl and the robe. One who went into town for alms. Then the Blessed One looked back and addressed the Venerable Rahula thus. Rahula, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material forms should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Now, this kind of sets up a certain tension in the dramatic structure of the sutta, doesn't it? Because first of all, they just start off and it's a fairly early morning, and they're wandering along the road for alms, and you know, would have been quite cute, right? Is the Buddha wandering along? And Rahul, we don't know how old Rahula was, okay? Presumably, the commentary will give us a date. Let's see. Rahula was 18, okay? So. Maybe that's so.
He's referred to as the Venerable Rahula. Would that mean anything?
Yeah, it's hard to say. When in other rules in the Vinaya, when the monks referred to the novices, they would say Samarudesa. It was like a particular term of address for the novices. Avuso, it is Avuso Samarudesa. But it seems that the terms of address weren't so standardized in that time, so kind of hard to say whether it means anything or not. Yeah. But yeah. So who knows, where does this passage come from?
Anatta-lakkhana
Sutta. Okay, very good. The discourse on not self. Yeah, the Buddha's second discourse. Alright. So, this being one of the very standard, very important passages, so I'll just go through this passage briefly. Whatever rupa, the rupa here of course being the first one of the five aggregates. And what does rupa mean?
Oh.
Form. And what does it mean?
The body. This.
Anything else?
Simply material stuff.
Material stuff? Did the Buddha believe in material stuff?
It was a convention of everyday speech.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty safe. Yeah, yeah. Rupang. Rupa, what is it?
The two men in the boat.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, thanks. which domain in which part?
In the part on the one, the ignorance, consciousness, all that, and then you come to the two.
Namarupa.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking
for. Namarupa, that's Namarupa.
But if it's all five?
All five what? Aggregates?
Eyes and nose.
Ah, the senses. Yeah, it is. Yeah, and the objects of the senses as well. Yeah, and one of the interesting things about the way that rupa is used in the suttas is that it's not used with a sense of ontological commitment. That is to say, it doesn't mean that the Buddha wasn't saying there is or is not kind of material stuff that exists. Okay, but rupa has more of an impression of appearance. So a rupa of something is actually a picture. Also, you paint a picture, and that's a rupa of something. Right? So we have a Buddha rupa is like the form of the Buddha, the appearance of the Buddha, but it's not the thing itself. Yeah, and actually rupa can mean something which is. You can also translate it sometimes as seeming. Yeah, so seeming. Yeah, so you have like piya rupa. Piya means dear or delightful, so piya rupa means delightful seeming. Yeah? So the Buddha would say, you know, all these sense objects which are piya rupa, they're delightful seeming. Okay, so rupa has this already when we're talking about it, rather, whereas in from a Western materialist point of view, the rupa is the most, or is often assumed to be, the most kind of obvious and solid things. It's like our epistemological foundation. We know that there is this stuff here, and we build up everything else from that. Whereas when we talk about it from an Indian perspective, that's already appearance, okay? It's seeming. And then that then shows that a very important fact, which is that our experience and knowledge of the material world is something. We just know how it appears to us, that's all. We don't know actually what I can look at. It looks like a table, it looks like wood, it feels like this, but we can't know an essence of it. We can't even know if it has got an essence. And of course we know, according to quantum physics and so on, it doesn't really have an essence. It's just kind of energies which manifest and looks like it's solid, although it's not really solid. So yeah.
Is that anything experienced, including, let's say, this feeling of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha, or like these feelings like pulling you away, wanting you to do something, which forces you to drive, and this feeling of self? Like, anything experienced?
No. Because then they're becoming the other khandhas, but it's physical experience. Yeah? Things that are aspects of physical experience. So basically anything which can be an object of the five senses can be included under rupa.
Five senses?
Yeah. And also in the sixth sense, rupa is very broad. It includes also recollections and so on of physical stuff that's happening in the mind. So imagination, images in the mind is also a rupa. So if you think about the house or something like that, then that's also a rupa.
Because it's a very coarse kind of category.
It's a very broad category, yeah. That's why rupa jhanas are rupa jhanas, because they're based on an image which is derived on a material thing. Yeah? So rupa is much broader than we might think about it. Okay? So atita nagata pachupannam, past, present and future. Atita, what has gone past? Anagata, not yet come. Pachupanna, present. So what does that mean?
All time.
Exactly what it says.
What does past, present and future mean?
In whatever way you can conceive.
Mm-hmm.
You perceive it in the past, future or present.
So that means like when you're young and beautiful, and then you know when you're old and haggard and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, you tell them to. I didn't say.
On Richard.
He said watch it. when you're old and beautiful in a different way. Yes. But what's this talking about? Of course, it's talking about self. Yeah. So what physical self did I have in the past? So in a sense, you can understand where you have kind of a psychological attachment to a body or something like that in the past. But also, it's talking about past lives and future lives, isn't it? Yeah. So it's because it's specifically talking about a self. So whatever part of a self, whatever physical form you may have had in past lives, also in future lives, it's also included.
Is he talking about change?
Well, it's the assumption under there, isn't it, that it would be changed, otherwise it would be eternal, yeah? That's one of the things that's showing the connection with impermanence, yeah? Ajhatan wa bahidha wa, meaning?
Internal
and external. Pertaining to oneself, literally ajhatan, pertaining to oneself, and bahidha, outside. So notice the enclitic particle. Disjunctive enclitic particle, otherwise known as all. Yes, and what does that mean? So remember, it's talking about self and your attachment to self. So what is the internal self and the internal form that you attach to yourself and an external form you attach to yourself?
Some kind of soul theory.
Some kind of soul theory.
This body here, and some kind of body externally.
You have an external body, like what?
I know. So, for instance, if someone astral traveled, they have the body that which they traveled with, and the body that was left behind.
Yeah, that would be included. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I thought it would mean hair of the head, hair of the body, all that. And the ego.
The ego?
Well, that's a sort of an inner self.
In eternal, yeah, but that's more covered by the other thing. It's a mental thing, so it's physical. Physical internal basically means this body, really. Okay? So that's really what physically internal.
Other
physical phenomena. So when you get attached to, you identify with your car or with your flower garden or something like
that.
The
identification with that is different.
It's a different kind of identification, but that it includes etam mama.
Whatever
is mine.
Okay.
Yeah, so mine is included there.
Yeah.
But also it does include this is myself. So you do have this phenomenon of the external soul, which is actually very, very interesting, where a soul, a person's soul becomes embodied in some kind of external object. Okay, so that's obviously like the theme of the Lord of the Rings, yeah? The Sauron's soul is embodied in the ring. Yeah? And so when the ring dies, he dies. But this is a classic folktale motif and found very often in mythology and so on. So people apparently did actually believe that this soul lived in some kind of external object. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Yeah?
I'm a bit confused as to the distinction internal, external. So internal is just, so the body is this...
Basically, yeah.
External?
The body is internal.
It's internal. Liver, kidneys.
Isn't there like something external?
I don't know. How do you make that...
Internal, external is of course, they're just relative concepts.
Yeah.
So it's internal relative to, say, other people's bodies or something like that.
Can I mention something that's relevant and
please do.
So there was this experiment where people put a fake hand in rather than their own hand, but the person believed it was their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then they smashed it with a hammer, mm-hmm. and actually felt pain.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't their hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after another thing is that they got hypnotized and said it wasn't your hand, and they put hot. They put a burning cold and they felt no pain and the skin didn't react.
Even though it was their hand.
Even though it was their hand.
Yeah.
They were believed it's not their hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's no distinction.
It's pretty nasty, isn't it? Does anyone done any experiments on the people who think of these experiments? They sort of safe. They don't want to always think of imagine these things. Yeah, no, they are very interesting. Interesting kinds of phenomena, and you can, you can see that your perception of mind in terms of your body is just a perception. That's what Oliver Sacks' book Leg to Stand On was all about. That, and you can just completely lose that, and that was what hypnotists do regularly. I was told once that somebody went to see the hypnotist, and they did all this thing, and you get someone up, and you do all these funny things with them, and then you say, okay, we're finished now, and I'm going to unhypnotize you in a moment. We're still under hypnosis, and you say to them, but there's just going to be one thing, is that when you get back to your seat, because it's like an auditorium full of people, when you get back to your seat, you're not going to have any bottom. So you won't be able to sit down. And so they just walk back, and then they sort of take them out of hypnosis, and they just walk back to their seat, and they just can't sit down. And they're just kind of standing around feeling kind of embarrassed and awkward. And everyone's looking at them and everyone's laughing and they're just thinking, oh my God, I can't sit down, I don't have a bottom to sit on. So, okay. Internal and external. So anything internal, these are just relative concepts, okay? And it's simply clarifying that the self is not just something which is in here, but it can be out there as also it can be the self. So anything which is an object of the five senses also would be external. Yeah, except for maybe the object of the fifth sense, the sense of touch would be internal. Other senses may be external. Olarikangwa, sukumangwa, coarse and refined. So a coarse one may be like when we have different kinds of bodies and so on, but also in terms of rebirth, like you could become an animal or you become a deva or something like that, in different kinds of bodies. Hinangwa, parinitangwa, inferior or superior, and of course notice that hina is always meaning inferior, never means small, doesn't mean small and big body, it means inferior body. So that's basically similar to olarikangwa sukumangwa. Yeah, yang dure santikewa, okay, so far or near. And so again, this is kind of emphasizing that even though we normally think of the self as being here, but actually it can be a long way away. Our self can be a long way away. And you kind of feel that emotionally sometimes, don't you? Like, maybe if you're very much in love with somebody and then you go a long way away, you feel like your self is torn in two, yeah? And if you left your heart behind, yeah? And so,
Really?
So I've heard, yes. I used to sing these songs about this kind of stuff, so presumably it wasn't all rubbish. I don't know. Oh, baby, I'm so far away from home. And I miss my baby so.
Yeah.
Okay, sabbang rupang. And then to sum it all up, all form. Sabbang rupang. Netam na. Which breaks up na etang, okay? So it's na etang. Netang mama means mine. No, na, and this one is na eso, not that aham asmi. Okay, so that's how it breaks up. Na eso aham asmi. No. Okay, so we resolve that compound. Hold on. Neso, maybe there's a bit of thing there. Sorry?
Does A and S occur regularly?
A and S?
Yes.
Us.
Yes.
Us me. Neso, hamas me. Not, it is not mine, and that's. This is the this is virtually the exact opposite of the very famous Upanishadic phrase tad tuangasi, thou art that. And so this is almost exactly the same as saying thou art not that, except it's in first person, I am not that. Nameso atati, and this is not my self. Nameso, and that's a sandhi consonant, so that nameso, that doesn't actually belong there. It's actually na eso ata, but that's just put in there to distinguish the na and the e. It's just a meaningless little n there, just to confuse you, right? Doesn't really belong. Nameso atati. So these reflect three different aspects of the way that we attach to a notion of self, and thinking of something as mine, then craving is the foremost. Okay, we want, have, it's mine. Yeah, and then neso hamasmi. Then this is what they call mana or conceit, which is basically identification with something. Okay, so identification is what we call conceit or mana. And nameso atta is a view, okay, and so that's referring to an actual formulated theory about a self, okay. So if you say you have the idea that myself will survive death or something like that, then this is theory about it. And so this is more the netam mama is just an instinctual craving. Neso hamasmi is a sort of existential identification as a self. And nameso atati is the theoretical view or intellectual view. Okay? All right? Sorry? Okay. Evmetang, thus you should see that. Yathabhutang, meaning? As it has come to be. Bhuta being the?
Bhu.
Bhu. Bhu. And which? The Bhu. Our famous Bhu. We've made in our Pali class. Bhu. The Bhu. And what was the grammatical form of it?
Bhavanti and all that.
No. But this particular one. We haven't made it in our Pali class, so that's probably a bit of it. It's actually a past participle, okay? So literally, how do you say a past participle of is? No, that's a it has been ised. Been created. So something like it has been conditioned, as it has been conditioned. It's brought into being by conditions. Daniel.
Going a little bit back to this is mine, and how that relates to craving. The experience of something mine and craving, it doesn't seem to be different. For example, if this is my mind and I want to control it, or this is mine and I want to, there's this force, mine and that craving seems to be the same. Could you sort of clarify if they're the same or what the relationship is between them?
The idea of mine and the craving.
And the craving. If something's like mine, it seems that that attitude or that view of something's mine seems to be the same as that force or that craving wanting to
Yeah, sure.
Is it the same or
is
how
it the same? I think yeah, basically the same, yeah. I mean, whether you want to distinguish it conceptually or not, I'm not sure. But basically, yeah, it's the same. Yeah, that's the aspect or the mode in which when craving predominates or is the main force, that's the mode that identity takes. Yeah?
Craving happens in the mind, isn't it? Or
craving happens in the mind, yeah. So in a way, you can think of craving, conceit, and views. You can think of them as separate kinds of defilements, but by putting them in this way, they're all different aspects of the self. Yeah, and so the aspect of self, which is associated with craving, is what we call, thinking of something as mine.
You said it's the form which it takes.
Yeah.
If craving is in the mind, how come you still live in the body?
Craving is in the mind.
Yeah,
craving is in the mind, how can we feel it in the body? Perhaps the mind is in the body as well. Or the body is in the mind, yeah. One or the other.
Okay.
Yeah. Where else would you feel? In the fridge? Samapanyaya, right wisdom. With right wisdom, dathabang, one should see it. Thus one should see it with as it has come to be with right wisdom. Rup. Okay, so that's that passage. Now, in doing this passage, the Buddha is quoting from the Anattalakkhana Sutta, yeah, and quoting from this very basic passage which is found in so many dozens and dozens of suttas. It's one of the essential textual bits, and in text studies we call this a pericope. I believe the pronunciation is. Fortunately, Adi is not here to correct me. Pericope. I believe only barbarians pronounce it pericope. Okay. And like I used to, until I heard Rod pronouncing it pericope. Oops. Pericope, yeah? So pericope is a textual unit which can be basically cut and pasted and used in different ways in the texts. And so this, you know, you have things like the jhana formula and the satipatthanas and things like that. And this is one of the central pericopes, especially dealing with the not-self and the five aggregates. And so my theory would be that this text quite possibly was originally collected in a collection corresponding with the Kandha Samyutta. Okay, so this is quite possible in the Samyutta Nikaya, where this passage is found repeatedly. So just to notice that the Buddha is basically quoting himself there. All right. Then Rahula says, "Rupmeva nukho Bhagava, rupmeva nukho sugatati." Rupmeva, only rupa. That's the one. Only rupa, sugata. Rupampi, okay. So then rupampi, p being another one of these enclitic particles. This one being conjunctive enclitic particles. This is the, yeah, this is sugata, yeah. This is, does it say, it's the same as the word sugato, yeah. Vocative form. So rupampi, also rupa, pi here meaning also form, also vedana, also sanya, also sankara, also vijnana. Okay, so all of the five aggregates, five khandhas, and oh look,
yeah,
the little squiggles have come back again. They're just so unpredictable. So, of course, kind of suggesting that, I mean, it's kind of interesting, if he had really been ordained for such a long time, he didn't realize that a basic teaching like that should be applied to all of the five aggregates. Kind of interesting. But I suppose perhaps, you know, it may well be a maturity thing, that perhaps, you know, the novices are not sort of taught such philosophical teachings and things like that. So, They're just taught how to make the porridge and to clean the monk's runes and stuff like that, you know.
Maybe he was just worried he was getting a lecture
and he was just playing along.
Is that all
that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Rupameva. So then Venerable Rahula considered thus. So what are these things anyway? Should have gone too far. Rupampi, Vedana. What's Vedana?
Feeling.
What kind of feeling?
Body feeling.
Like, is that like in Toyota? Oh, what a feeling?
No, like ouch.
Ouch is a feeling?
Pleasant, painful, and not pleasant and painful.
Pleasant, painful, and neither pleasant nor painful. Mm-hmm. Is that is feeling a good translation for that? Is that what feeling means? We get used to using. Actually, I forget what these things mean, because I've Buddha hybrid English. I've been using it for so long. I forget what actual English English is.
Is it okay to think? I think of it as anything that either pulls you to something, which is pleasant. Like,
yep.
I guess extra self pleasant would be something that pulls you towards something.
Yeah.
And pleasant something that would
repels.
Yeah. And then neither is like it has no effect on you.
Yeah, yeah.
So like a
it's a functional definition.
Is that an okay way to?
I think so. Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Isn't
Vedana?
Vedana,
yeah.
So Vedana is just Vedana by itself, and then you have Sankara that goes with that, just pulling and pushing you. But Vedana's just.
Vedana has a tendency to pull or push you, but the actual movement would be the Sankara, the actual energy of it. Yeah. Yeah. They talk about. It talks about. It talks about. Sort of feeling, it talks about the kind of a feeling which has a, I can't remember what it is now, it has like the nature or the tendency to create those kinds of responses, but it doesn't have to, because obviously if you have strong equanimity, then you won't be pushed or pulled. But it has that
is it the feeling
tendency.
In the mind, or?
Well, let's have a look here, what does it say? Experiencing of affective and emotional states, she had a feeling of euphoria, he had terrible feelings of guilt. This sounds not very politically correct to me. I disliked him and the something impression, a vague idea in which some confidence is placed. His impression of her was favourable. What are your feelings about the crisis? It strengthened my belief in his sincerity. I had a feeling that she was lying. So it's obviously not that kind of feeling. Spirit, the general atmosphere of place or situation and the effect it has on people, the feel of the city excited him, a clergyman improved the tone of the meeting, it had the smell, obviously not that one, a physical sensation that you experience, he had a queasy feeling, I had a strange feeling in my leg, he lost all feeling in his arm. So this one, you lose all feeling in your arm, comes close to experience, doesn't it? Yeah, you lose all consciousness. Touch, the sensation proves you have pressure receptors in the skin, she likes the touch of silk on her skin, the surface had a greasy feeling. An intuitive understanding of something, he had a great feeling for music. Obviously, you know that one. Right. Feeling. Feelings convey information about situations on both conscious and subconscious levels via at least 30 neurochemicals acting alone or in concert in complex ways. Communication from essence. Misspelled. There are only two feelings, pleasure and unpleasure. Note that feeling is not a reaction. Okay, so that's quite interesting. It's a bit similar. Obviously, we have the middle one, but there comes that point where that Jen just raised that it's not the actual reaction itself, but it's that it has a tendency to provoke a reaction. Okay, feeling quality. The quality of integrity through which a historic property evokes the aesthetic or historic sense of past time or place, perhaps not. Finally, of which are three kinds. Suffering, pleasure, no suffering, no pleasure is the condition for craving. There you go, there's the Buddhist one. So it's obviously the correct one. But it is interesting because you know, it's used in so many very, very different ways in English, yeah? And then a Buddhist translator 100 years ago or something tries to adopt it as being the best that they can get for Vedana, right? But it probably doesn't quite fit into any exactly of the things, but it becomes used so frequently in Buddhism it then feeds back into the English language. So this isn't a Buddhist thing at all, this is just on Google, but we get the Buddhist definition is appearing there, so it's quite interesting, isn't it? So, once more with feeling. Oh, what a feeling. So, something painful and neutral. Okay, so what's Sanya?
Consciousness.
Sanya is consciousness, is it?
Perception.
Perception?
That's something like a tree, you say, that's Sanya.
Something like a tree?
Yeah, when you say tree, then you have an image of the tree.
Have an image, okay, so it's something which is evoked, yeah? Yeah. Okay. Percept, the representation of what is perceived, basic component in the formation of a concept. That's actually quite similar to the Buddhist meaning of perception. The basic component in the formation of a concept, and sometimes it's called. There's one rendering which tried to capture that and ended up being a bit clumsy, but that's pretty good. A way of conceiving something. Luther had a new perception of the Bible. Process of perceiving. Okay, so that's a thing that's used in certain psychological contexts. It's referring to like sense perception. So you have like a certain process that goes on when you see something, for example. That's not so close to the Buddhist way of looking at it. Knowledge gained by perceiving. A man admired for the depth of his perception. It's not really. Sensing. Becoming aware of something via the senses. Again, that's not really exactly what it means. In psychology and the cognitive sciences, perception is the process of acquiring, interpreting, selecting, and organizing sensory information. The word perception comes from the Latin capere, meaning to take, the prefix per meaning completely. Okay? So that's pretty good. Yeah? The process of acquiring, interpreting, selecting, and organizing sensory information. And I think that's a pretty good definition of samya. Yeah? Another one is the Blessed Union of Soul albums released in 2005 on All Tracks Records. Vedana Sanya Sankara, yeah. The five khandhas is not necessarily sequential. Yeah. And there's other kind of teachings where these things are displayed as like one causes the other and so on. You have like a causal process, but in this it's more structural. There may be some causal element between them, but it's more structural rather than causal. So it doesn't necessarily imply that they go one after the other.
What structure is there that doesn't?
It doesn't go one after the other. Well, when things sit on top of each other, for example, they're all there at the same time.
What's consciousness in Pali?
Well, we'll come to that in a minute. Just wait for it. Don't get ahead of yourself, man.
No,
recognition and interpretation of detected stimuli. That's also pretty good. The active psychological process in which stimuli are selected and organized into meaningful patterns. That's a very good definition. Yeah? The active psychological process in which stimuli are selected and organized into meaningful patterns. Yeah, that's very good.
So stimuli might be a good translation.
That's more like passa. Passa is quite close to stimulus. Yeah. But this is the organization and of things. But that's actually very good. So this is interesting to see this, because this is it is a controversial thing in Buddhism and the translation of these things. Like, how do you render these words? And some people still don't like to use perception in Thai. They translate perception sanya as kwam jam, which just means memory. Okay, and so that's a bit of a misleading translation. It doesn't mean memory as such, although of course it's involved with memory, because again, the complex procedure by which humans select, attend to, and process stimuli. Of course, that procedure is a learnt procedure. Yeah, you learn to do that through living and through experimenting. You learn to perceive hot and cold by putting your hand on something and going ouch. Yeah, and so these are learnt things which become structures in the mind, and. It's related to memory in that way, but it's not actually the same as what we mean when we say memory. Okay, sankhara. What's sankhara?
Mental processes.
Aren't everything we've done isn't sanya a mental process? It's mental. It's a process.
Intention,
sankhara.
Creation of mind. Now, if you see in the television,
yeah.
If you see elephant,
yeah.
You actually the elephant in the television is about 2-3 inches or
uh-huh.
50 mil.
How can an elephant
see a full size elephant?
You're Chandra, you're not allowed to tell fibs, okay? How can an elephant be 2 or 3 inches high?
In your mind, you transform that to the real...
to the real elephant. Yeah, that's more sanya. That's more sanya, yeah. It's like connecting sense experience with pre-existing concepts, yeah, and ideas is more like the role of sanya. Yeah.
Vijnana must be...
Sankara is more like screaming and running away from the elephant. Danya.
So is sankara any time when the mind moves? Is that what we could label as sankara? But not moving in reaction. Any time the mind moves, if there's like movement or sort of movement in the mind, change.
Don't Vedana's change?
Vedana is
Sanya's change?
But it's like just that. With an input, but when the mind moves, is that sankara? The word sankara, does that point to?
It does. It is certainly has an active, very active flavor to it. Yeah, it's actually the root is to do. So from the root kar, to do.
So is it a general? Is it a very broad word that points to? Any movement in the mind?
Any active activity as opposed to passive activity.
Well, like anything, reaction,
sure, it's
anything. Anything in the mind?
Okay, basically it means intention. Okay? That's the basic meaning of it. And, or will. Will's a bit old-fashioned these. And so it's because of that it's like a creative force, okay? The sankhara is a creative force, and it's always defined in the suttas in terms of jetana meaning volition. Okay, so it's a volitional force or a creative force in the mind, and so it's what you choose to do about things. Okay, so for example, your perception perceives that it's an elephant running towards you, and feeling feels the kind of unpleasant feelings, recognition of your imminent death, and then sankhara runs away. Run away! That sankhara is the one who goes, run away, and then you run. So sankhara is the creative force, and sankhara in Buddhism fulfills the same role as God does in other religions. Okay, it's the force that creates the universe. But of course it creates the universe in a continual, sustained way. Every moment it's being created.
Does that mean that you see what you want to see rather than what you actually see? Or you hear what you want to hear rather than what you actually hear?
That's part of it, but that also would be partly included with sanya, because sanya is also programming you to look at certain things, yeah, according to your past experience. Yeah, but you can reinforce that through your choices and through your sankhara. Yeah. And that's what will create those patterns in the first place. Sometimes, now, sankhara is a bit confusing because it gets used in the Abhidhamma as a catch-all basket where you can throw everything in. So you have like 50 or something jetasikas, or mental factors, which get thrown into the basket of sankhara, one of which is jetana or volition. Okay? But in the suttas, it's always just jetana. Okay, the other ones are not mentioned as part of that. So it's not necessarily to say that the Abhidhamma analysis is wrong. Mm. It's just to say that that's not how the suttas treat it. Okay, so you have to bear that in mind when we're reading the suttas. It basically means intention or volition, an active force in the mind that actually does things, the maker. It's what basically what Ajahn Brahm calls the doer.
Is this asava? Asava is like when you sit and then...
the outline.
You should do this. That comes out in an experience of intention. Is asavas and sankara synonyms?
No.
Is my understanding of asavas correct? Like any kind of mind, like pulls you out, making you out of delusion that you have to do something.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean that's.
Is that sankara? No.
Okay. The idea that asava means outflow is fairly interpretive. It doesn't actually literally mean outflow. can be understood in many different ways. Etymologically, it more likely means inflows, in, as in influences, but it actually is also used in the sense of something which has gone rotten, like a corruption or a poison. So to say that asava means outflows is a bit simple. Well, it certainly can encompass that aspect of the mind, but that's not actually what the word itself means. But generally speaking, that we make a distinction between the defilements and the karma, okay, and well, the action. Sankara is also equivalent to karma, okay? So we can make a little equivalence here. Sankara. I might bother with my. Should I bother with my? I probably should. I'm supposed to be teaching time. Sankara with my little. Sankara is always. Sankara equals. Oops. Equals. Chetana. Right. Equals. Karma.
Translation of the English chanting, it was chemical formations, then they changed it to mental formations, and now they've turned it back to chemical formations.
Right, well, yeah, exactly. I'm sure that's got something to do with that whole process, yeah. It's the same root, okay? So the root there, kam, and karoti, even though it doesn't look like the same root, actually, it is the same root. So, and the point of this in the context of the Buddha said was that the kama or the sankara originally meant the ritual, okay? So it means work in a general sense, but it also means work in the sense of a ritual. So that was what was efficacious. Yeah, you accomplished your spiritual goal by doing a ritual, by doing a kama. And we still use the word kama in the same sense in the Sangha. Like a Sangha kama is an act which is done by the Sangha. Okay, so we do an ordination or something like that. We call it a Sangha kama. So it's an act. But of course, the Buddha said that it's the inner aspect of that, the chetana, which is the crucial point. So you have this formula that it says, and some places where it says, and I'm 100% sure this is right, but I'll just something like this, kayo. Something like that. And this is a statement found in some places in the suttas. Asava kaya, gamma kayo, gamma kaya, dukkha kayo. Can anyone read that for me?
Something body.
Right. No, this is kaya, not gaya. Asava kaya. And we talked about kaya many times in the sutta class.
Is that like rupa kaya?
No. That's gaya. This is kaya.
Kaya. Act thing.
Kaya. What's kaya? Come on. Everyone, you should know what kaya means. We've met it a thousand times in the suttas. Means
body?
Hitting yourself? No, that's kaya. What's this?
Give us a hint.
A hint? Give me a hint. We get kaya. No. Not.
Body.
Not.
Not
equals
kaya.
Yes. That doesn't equal that. What's kaya?
As in kaya?
It's only been in every sutta that we've done.
Time?
Time is Kala. Gamma Kayo. Come on. Asavakaya? Anyone ever heard of that? This is Asavakaya. This is one of the most common phrases in Buddhism. Asavakaya. Means ending.
In ending, or finish?
Yes, that kind of ending.
The ending as of asavas is the ending of karma.
As in the ending of birth.
The ending of dukkha.
Right.
Oh, well, there we are.
Right.
The ending of the asavas is the ending of karma. The ending of karma is the ending of dukkha.
That's right. But you might want to just specify the grammatical form slightly more precisely.
Okay. And karma this ends, asavas end.
That's what it means. Exactly. When karma ends, asavas end. That's exactly what it means. But the grammatical form is the... ablative. Okay, very good. So, from... From, but also having a causal meaning. Having a causal meaning is in due to. Okay, so from the ending, but also due to. But with is very close. And you can translate it as with, if you like. But with or from or due to. Due to the ending of the asavas, which I would translate asava as simply defilement. The word kilesa we usually translate as defilement, but kilesa actually only appears rarely in the suttas, as it happens. Okay, asava is used much more commonly.
So what's a defilement? Is it just bad habits or anything that's unwholesome?
Greed, hatred, and delusion.
Whatever binds you to
everything. Everything. Greed, hatred, and delusion.
Okay. So is the from the ending of the asavas is the ending of karma. From the ending of karma is the ending of dukkha. So what does it mean?
Well, just exactly what you said.
Like it says in the practicing the low eightfold path leads to the ending of karma.
Yeah, fine. But what does the structure of that sentence mean? Mm-hmm. What do we learn from that?
Don't act out of defilements.
What we learn is that the defilements are more fundamental and more basic than the acts which are committed as a basis, that are committed based on them, okay? So the defilements are the most fundamental. They're like a motivation for action. Okay, so defilements are a motivation. They're what stimulate the action, but they're not the act itself. Okay?
Not the sticks.
Sorry?
They're not the sticks or the swords.
They're not the sticks or the swords. They are the
thoughts.
Thoughts? But even before that, they're the motivation which causes you to have negative thoughts or harmful thoughts or harmful intentions, yeah? So motivations and defilements, asavas, kilesas, all these things are what prompt the action, okay? And the karma itself is the actual doing that you do as a result of that, which may be physical doing, may be mental doing. Okay?
What about
kusala
karma?
What about
kusala
karma?
It's a type of karma.
A type of karma?
So the soul is connected to kusala karma.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because you have bhavasava is the defilement of wanting to get reborn. So you still have even with kusala karma, as long as it's karma, then you're not going to reach the end of dukkha. So the arahant would have jetana, but then they wouldn't have karma. So that equation wouldn't work for an arahant. I mean, it's just a terminological thing, but basically it means that he can still choose and will, or she can still choose or will. Almost got out there. But they can't do so, they're not doing so as a result of defilements. And what that means is that our ordinary everyday acts are not entirely motivated by defilements. Okay, so it's not trying to say those that they're all just defilement, but that there's a component of defilement mixed in there. Yeah. Which side is it? Yeah.
So it's like an expression of our delusion. I don't know, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good definition of it. Yeah. That's why you have sankara, you know, avijja paccaya sankara. Yeah. The sankara is the expression of delusion. Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing in between avijja and sankara.
No, not independent origination, no. So that's again, that's the same relationships. You know, avijja is one of the asavas, sankara is equivalent to kama, so those two are next to each other.
Avijja is like you have a flow of avijja.
Have a flow of avijja?
Yeah.
No, not so much a flow as a kind of great big muddy quicksand, which just kind of sits there in a kind of gloopy kind of mass. I don't know if it flows. Yeah. Because, I mean, in a sense you could say that, but it's also, it's not, avijja itself is almost it's almost too primordial. It's not differentiated enough. You know? Whereas the other kinds of defilements which are built come out of that greed, hatred and delusion, they're more kind of the active things that are flowing into the world, whereas the avijja itself is just sort of just this kind of morass.
What does sankara paccaya?
Vijnana.
Didn't we say vijnana, vedana, sankara?
No, I just said that there wasn't linear, but vijnana is the end of, vijnana does come after sankara in the five aggregates as well. Yeah, we haven't got that to that yet. That's a whole other discussion. Okay, so that's a little bit anyway about sankaras and so on. You got all that? That's good. Good to go on. Then vijnanampi. What's vijnana?
Consciousness.
And what does consciousness mean? What is vijnana? Is that right? Is consciousness the right translation?
Awareness. It's the constantly changing
thing. An alert cognitive state in which you're aware of yourself and your situation, as in he lost consciousness. Well, that's obviously not what you mean. Anyway, awareness, having knowledge of. He had no awareness of his mistakes, his sudden consciousness of the problem he faced, their intelligence and general knowingness was impressive. Consciousness is a quality of the mind generally regarded to comprise qualities such as subjectivity, self-awareness, sentience, sapience, and the ability to perceive the relationship between oneself and one's environment. So that's quite a complex notion, isn't it?
What was that word next to sentience?
Sapience. I mean, this is, well, what sapient means, in fact, is, as we all know, is wisdom, sageness, or the ability to apply knowledge or experience or understanding in the common sense and insight. Sapience. Judgment, discernment. What's that? Sapience.
Can you get some definitions in French?
The banquet of sapience.
No, that looks good. Sapience.
Yeah.
Sapience.
Wisdom. Okay. At this point in the scientific exploration of this phenomena, it cannot be defined rigorously. Consciousness usually, but not always, involves some form of attentional selection and a rapidly decaying form of information storage. Well, we can all identify with that, can't we? Okay, a philosophical explanation of what consciousness is or how it might be explained eludes us. If we are to stick with what it's like to be a conscious human being, we have no explanation. If we try to explain consciousness in terms of what goes on in our brains, the sheer feel of consciousness itself is, and it breaks off there, which is exactly right, yeah? That's part of consciousness. That's an important part of it. Yeah.
Like views and
mm-hmm.
understanding.
Yeah.
that's something different than consciousness?
Yeah, see, this is the problem, is that in the five khandhas, there's no reason to think that the five khandhas was meant to be a complete description of all of our mental factors, okay? But the Abhidhamma tradition wanted to make it into that complete description, which is why they put everything else under Sankhara. So all of those other things that you mentioned would be lumped in the Abhidhamma under Sankhara, which is fine. If you think, I want somewhere to put them in the five khandhas, well, why not put them under there? But it's kind of missing the point that it's not necessarily meant to be a complete description of all of our mental factors. In fact, it's obviously not. It's just five things. I mean, how can it be a complete description of our mental world? But it's five important things which are central in the formation of the notion of identity and self. And that's really the crucial thing. So vijnana generally is much simpler, more fundamental than what's being talked about in these things as consciousness. Yeah.
Is it like what, you know, Ajahn Brahm terms, like the knower, and then
the knower, yeah.
Rajan's like the mind, like
yep.
the pure, like just the mind. When
yep.
Is that that's vijnana?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cognition.
Cognition, I might use, a conscious process of the mind by which one becomes aware of thoughts and perceptions, including all acts of perceiving, thinking, and something.
That's a good one.
Perceiving, thinking, and consulting position.
Control F.
No, anything was on that page. Shoot. Glossary of terms. Cognition. The conscious process in the mind by which one becomes aware of thoughts and perceptions, including all aspects of perceiving, thinking, and remembering. Knowing, awareness, perception. High-level functions carried out by the human brain, including comprehension and formation of speech. Visual perception and construction, calculation ability, attention, information processing, memory and executive functions such as planning, problem solving and self-monitoring. It's pretty complex, isn't it? It's not really saying all that much.
Adi Mutha has this book called Evolution of Consciousness, I think it's called, or something like that.
Yeah.
The first chapter is really fascinating. It's got this long description of how we make consciousness and most of the things we do.
Right,
Really good.
And that's using consciousness in this complex sense of consciousness as a perception of self.
Self-consciousness.
It took me ages to work that out when I was reading that book, because I had this kind of Buddhist hybrid English meaning of consciousness in my mind, and I couldn't work out what he was meaning, but he's referring it to it in a sense of this kind of sense of subjectivity and self-awareness. Yeah, that's. I was wondering where that book would go to. Okay, that's good. Good. Yeah, Julian Jane. Conscious cognition, here we are.
No, there you go.
Conscious mental activities. General term, people gain knowledge, intellectual. Noah, known. Thinking, learning. See, I tried to use cognition instead of consciousness for vijnana. One of the problems with consciousness for vijnana is that it doesn't have a verb, whereas vijnana has a verb. So Bhikkhu Bodhi and so on will translate, they'll say consciousness, but then they say one cognizes as the verb form. Yeah, and so that you lose the connection between the two words. So I tried to keep that by saying
cognition and
cognition. Yeah. See, this awareness, one of the three aspects of the mind, the others being affection, feeling or emotion, so that's like sanya, and conation, willing or desiring, would be sankhara. They may work as a whole, but any one may dominate any mental process. So in that sense, that's pretty reasonably good. Yeah, that's pretty similar to what we're talking about here. But it is used, obviously, very broadly, and used to mean much more complex things as well. Cognition is used to, in very several loosely related ways, refer to a faculty for the human-like processing of information, applying knowledge, and changing preferences.
That's a bit of problems with this one.
Yeah. Maybe natural and artificial, conscious and not conscious. Therefore, they're analysed from different perspectives and in different contexts. So, this is a bit difficult to make an actual translation for vijnana, but basically vijnana means the awareness of something. So the awareness of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mental objects, okay, is vijnana.
I understand it in the sense that you have the form, and then the three different things, you know, the form, the eye, and the consciousness, and the meaning of the three is contact.
Yeah.
So in order, you have to have the form that touches, say, for instance, you touch your body, and that experience, that you're actually aware of that experience, the actual experience in itself
is probably consciousness. It's a vijnana, just the knowing of what that is, yeah. And it's also said, the other thing which is also interesting is that the other four aggregates stand against consciousness, okay? So the division in the five khandhas is not, again, in contrast with the Abhidhamma systems, they always divide it up into mind and body, okay? But in the suttas, they never divide things up that way. They divide it up into rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara here, and vijnana on the other side. And so these, they're said to lean up against. And so this is why they're called upadana khanda, is the grasping aggregates, because they can grasp things with the thumb. Vijnana is the thumb. Yeah? So the model is the hand. Five of them. And in the number five, always the basic model is the hand. Yeah, so it's 1 plus 4.
That's interesting. Is mindfulness, what is mindfulness? Is that the same thing as vijnana?
Not really, no. No.
It's part of sankhara, right?
In the Abhidhamma, it's part of sankhara, yeah.
What's the meaning up against?
Yeah. You grab hold of, you want to eat things, yeah? So you grab hold of them, you grab hold of sounds, you grab hold of sights. You want to eat them, bring them in and chew them up. So you grab them. Upadana plumping.
This is the consciousness that is
liberating. Consciousness can only work with these other four. Yeah?
So if you can see the touch without them, these four come together?
No, it doesn't really kind of work like that. You can't see the touch without all those four. All those four things, all those five things are always there in any moment of experience. Yeah?
Even in jhanas,
for a Buddha or anything like that. That's the nature of experience. So this is, remember that the five khandhas come underneath the first noble truth of dukkha, right? Dukkha is to be fully known. Dukkha is not to be abandoned, right? So these five khandhas are not something to be abandoned, right? There's nothing wrong with that, okay? It's just that you have to understand that that's how it is. So it's parinyaya, to be fully known, right? The wrong thing is the attachment that we have for that process, okay? But the process itself is not wrong, it's just how things are.
We cannot abandon them because we're born with it.
You're born with it, yeah. Okay, what are you going to do with that?
What if your eye out, that gets rid of mine.
Yep.
Just through experience in
Arupa Samapati, yeah. Yep.
So then there's no rupa there.
It's still experience, but it's still conditioned by rupa. It has atita rupa, even in the formless attainments, because you can't get formless attainments without developing form attainments, and they are the condition. So it's still conditioned by rupa, even though it doesn't have any at the moment. It's conditioned. It's what they call in the Abhidhamma, they call parejata pachayo, is the previously existing condition for a later state. And so when the energy of that cloud falls, then the attainment comes down.
Do the khandhas unravel from any point, or do they just...
Do the khandhas unravel only in
Parinibbana? But from which point?
From which point? Yeah.
Like simultaneous meltdown.
Something like that, yeah. They just collapse all in a heap.
But then they didn't mean they had to start from
sankhara. Yeah, I mean, sankhara has both... In the five khandhas, sankhara really has an ethically neutral meaning. So an arahant still has sankharas. Okay? In other words, he or she still wills and chooses and so on. But and in that sense, sankhara is different from karma. So karma is an ethical thing, an ethical quality, whereas sankhara is more just psychological or neutral. Not so much every day, more like a technical term. Whereas karma is the moral term. Yeah? For the same thing. It's just slightly different contextual usage.
Ante, what is Rahulati? What's Lati? Because he's Rahula and he's Rahulo. And what's Rahulati?
How does he keep up with all these changes? I mean, he just doesn't know what he is half the time. Rahula Iti.
Iti. Ah. Inverted
commas. Okie dokie. I maybe need some bit of light here. I've got my glorious black screen there.
Is it the hour of the day or is it a storm?
I think it's got to do with the sun. Okay, so it's now 5:28 and we've got to the third paragraph.
We start from the beginning.
Alrighty. You read it. Okay, so that's all good. Then, Venerable Sarahula considered thus, who would go to the town for days today when being personally admonished by the Blessed One? Okay.
Why the word admonish sort of sounds as though he's been told off, but he wasn't.
Well, he was kind of told off. No, he was instructed.
I read a version of this where I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh.
Is that the same power?
Mm-hmm.
They're walking along and Rahul is feeling sorry for himself or something.
Uh-huh.
And the Buddha works it out that he's feeling something like that, or greedy or something. So he turns around and gives him this lecture.
Yeah.
The commentary thing is that he thinks that he's... He looks at the his father Buddha and thinks how beautiful he is, and he is also good looking. That's the commentary explanation.
Yeah. Which is kind of interesting in the context of Mahaprajapati as well. So that's kind of interesting. Then he went to a certain root of a tree and sat down, put his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. That means do meditation. So again, always, this little idiom here, sating upatabetwa, establish mindfulness in front. We always do that, but remember that this is, if we resolve that compound, sating upatabetwa, okay, sati, that gets resolved, okay, and then because you have a conjunct, the two vowels together there, these two vowels together, that kind of disappears. Okay, and the way it disappears in Pali is that because the Pali won't tolerate the two vowels together, that vowel disappears and it's replaced by a double P. Okay, and then this is the verb form, but if we were to put that into the noun form, we have sati bhakti sapience. No, you wouldn't. We would have. Hello. We would have sati bhakti. Oh, no. Okay. Or that P is sometimes there and sometimes not. That's just a spelling. So there's our word satipatthana. Okay. So this is how satipatthana comes. And it's exactly the same word as the sating upatthabetwa. All right. So what it means is he sits down and does satipatthana. So this was. the burden of the whole book, History of Mindfulness, is the end result of it is that satipatthana means meditation. There you go. This is simple. There's the Reader's Digest version of the History of Mindfulness. Satipatthana means meditation. All right.
What does meditation mean?
Meditation means what you do when you sit down cross-legged under a tree and watch your breath, or what are you doing? Exactly. And that's what satipatthana means. That's the text for the commentary. See History of Mindfulness, all right? Okay.
Herein.
Then, when... When he saw him, he said to Rahula, Anapanasati Rahula Bhavanang Bhavehi. Anapanasati Rahula Bhavita Bahulikata Mahaphala Hoti Mahani Sansati. Rahula, literally cultivate the cultivation of mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out. Okay, mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out, when it is cultivated and made much of, is of great fruit and of great benefit. Now here, Sariputta himself is quoting from the Samyutta Nikaya. So I mentioned before that the Buddha was quoting from the Khanda Samyutta in that passage, and now Sariputta is quoting from the Anapanasati Samyutta and using this phrase. Okay, so this is something I want to keep on emphasizing again and again, that when we look at these suttas, that the basic doctrinal core of them is basically taken from the Samyutta Nikaya. Okay, and the Majjhima is giving us more narrative and dressing and so on, and background, but the actual doctrines are just being quoted literally word for word from the Samyutta.
I thought the Samyutta came after the Majjhima in order to make it all a little bit more...
Make it a bit more one after the other.
Yes.
Yeah, but if you put the Majjhima after the Samyutta, then it wouldn't. Again, all I can say is see History and Mindfulness for the commentary on that one. Yeah. In my ever so humble opinion, the Samyutta is the most basic Buddhist canonical scripture, and the one on which all the others are based, or the proto-Samyutta, not exactly the Samyutta, but what the Samyutta would have been. Let's just pop over here and have a look at what the Venerable Anala has to say. Only the Pali has Rahula asking whether he's inquired if the instruction applies only to form. The Chinese doesn't have that little bit. And then it has that... But in both cases, he went away and started to start meditating. And in Sariputta comes up and tells him to meditate, do mindfulness of breathing. But in the Ekotara Agama presentation from the Chinese, and Ekotara Agama, of course, being of the
perhaps Mahasanghika school.
Thank you very much, Venerable. Perhaps Mahasanghika. It was the Buddha who came back from collecting alms and seeing Rahula sitting in meditation, told him to practice mindfulness of breathing. Okay, so that's quite an important difference. The Pali seems to suggest that Sariputta got the meditation instructions a bit wrong. Right, that's the implication if we look at the rest of the sutta. But in the Chinese version, it was the Buddha.
He got the instructions wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
And probably changed it to.
Yeah, I mean it would be kind of yeah. Anyway, continues with the Buddha instructing Rahula to develop contemplation of asubha and practice the four Brahma viharas. The Mahārāhulavāda Sutta also reports the Buddha giving such instructions to Rahula, which is how it proceeds by a detailed instruction on contemplation of the elements. This detailed instruction is not found at all in the Chinese version. So the whole section on the elements, which we're about to read, is only in the Pali, not in the Chinese.
It looks like the Pali people had a lot of fun with this one.
Yeah. Well, let's just read on a little bit more and then see how we go. Okay. Then when it was evening, Venerable Rahula rose from meditation, went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, how is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? And I should perhaps mention at this point that this word we have developed, okay, is actually a causative form from bhu. Okay, And so it means to make more, to make become, to make something become. Okay? To make something increase, to make it grow. Bhavana, so we important to, just to recognize that's the root of it. The word bhavana in modern day just means meditation. Okay, so we use it to mean meditation is a bhavana. But actually the root meaning of it is to make something more. So to chitta bhavana is like the development of the mind, making more of the mind. Okay? Okay, so he's asked about he goes and asks him about how do I practice anapanasati, and the Buddha then says, Rahula, whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified and clung to, that is, head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. Okay, so I don't think we have time to Google each one of these individually and see things. Tanya.
Okay.
Yes?
In terms of bhava, develop, you said it's to make more.
Make more of, yeah.
But I guess maybe could you correct this understanding? I thought it was more like develop the ability to restrain, develop an ability rather than make something more. Like what is it that you're making more of?
Well, you could make the ability more.
So it's an ability, it's like a skill that you're talking about, right? Just to
could be a skill, could be other things.
Do we leave it as vague?
Yeah, it's very vague. It just means making more of. Bhavana itself just means making more of something.
So it's just developing.
Yeah. It can be applied in any kind of context.
Okay.
Yeah. So then that just depends what the context is used. Yeah. So that's just to note that, because these days we use it just to mean meditation.
Okay.
But that's only one, that's actually just a shorthand from Chitta Bhavana or Samadhi Bhavana, which means meditation.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So this is kind of a bit of a mystery. Rahul asks the Buddha about mindfulness of breathing, and the Buddha replies about the four elements. So obviously we don't quite have time to go through all of them, but just to notice that the internal earth element is kakalang karigatang. It's nice onomatopoeic words here. Kakalang karigatang is the you used to say the crunchy and the crispy. Yeah? Yeah? The crunchy and crispy bits of the body and all of those kinds of things. The earth element's crunchy and crispy. Yeah, something like that. But that doesn't quite have the crackly. It's the crackly, crispy, crunchy.
Sort of more slimy and
well, it has those kind of slimy yuck things as well. Okay, so when one sees thus and so on and so forth, then the water element, and I think we've probably done these elements in other things, so I won't read through them right now. Yeah, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, so when one contemplates each of the elements and sees this is not me, this is not myself. So this could be understood as an expansion of the treatment in the originally was teaching about contemplating form, and then seeing it as not myself and so on. So this can be seen as an expansion of that. So the reading, if you just read it from the Pali, the very strong impression that it conveys is that Rahula really needed to do some contemplation on form, on rupa, for whatever reason. And the fact maybe there was a young guy, maybe he had a lot of sensual desire or something, is obviously perhaps an obvious explanation for that. And so Sariputta gave him more of a general meditation, okay, which he thought would be useful for him. But in fact the Buddha, with his more highly developed knowledge, knows more specifically that he needs to develop these body contemplations first as a foundation for his practice. Okay, so that's how I would read it, relying entirely just on the Pali. But we do remember that the Chinese is a bit different.
And for instance, because the Chinese lacks the four elements, right?
Mm.
But in this one, it doesn't give just the four elements; it gives the six.
I think it probably deflects the elements. Just check.
It's interesting to note that the one that is in the one that the Chinese is missing in the part of the Pali has the extra two.
Sorry?
In the sense that, you know, the there's this two kind of, when they use elements, it can either be the four or the six.
Or the five, yeah.
So in this.
This is five. Yeah, is it's it? Up to space, yeah, air and space.
Oh, okay, this is only five.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is, it seems that because the Pali one is, what is in the Pali is lacking from the Chinese,
yeah.
You can say that perhaps they kind of added that a bit later with the extra,
with the extra elements.
Maybe the extra element things is a later addition into the Pali tradition.
Yeah, and it could be. It seems to be standard in the Sarvastivada tradition, that they always have six elements. But that, you know, I mean, certainly that's that passage anyway is found in plenty of other suttas and also found in the Abhidhamma. But the more characteristic passage, which is very memorable and very beautiful, Bhatavi samang rahula bhavanang bhaveti. So develop the development which is the same as the earth, which is like the earth. Okay? And Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as develop meditation that is like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus and blood on the earth, and the earth is not repelled, humiliated and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that's like the earth. For when you develop meditation that's like the earth, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Rahula, develop meditation that's like the water. For when you develop meditation that's like the water, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people wash clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus and blood in water, and the water is not repelled, humiliated and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like the water. Develop meditation that's like fire. For when you develop meditation that's like fire, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people burn clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus and blood in fire, and the fire is not repelled, humiliated and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that's like fire. Develop meditation that's like air. For when you develop meditation that's like the air, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as the air blows on clean things and dirty things, on excrement, urine, spittle, pus, blood, and the air is not repelled, humiliated and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that's like the air. For when you develop meditation that is like the air, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Rahula, develop meditation that's like space. For when you develop meditation that's like space, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as space is not established anywhere, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that is like space, arisen, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. So this is an interesting variation presentation talking about space. Space is always a little bit difficult to handle in these kinds of things. Nakatachi patikito. Okay?
Doesn't have a standing place.
Yeah? A standing, establishing, planted. It's not planted anywhere. Patikitang means also planted. Established.
It doesn't say it's unconditioned.
Doesn't say it's unconditioned, no. Elsewhere it does say it's conditioned. Okay?
It's a lovely short paragraph.
Isn't it delightful, yeah? And then this next one, also quite interesting. Rahula, develop metta. When you develop metta, then whatever arisen ill will, vyapada, will be abandoned. Develop compassion, Rahula. When you develop compassion, then arisen vihesa, cruelty, will be abandoned. When you develop mudita, Rahula, when you develop mudita, then arisen arati will be abandoned. So arati I would translate as cynicism.
Ah.
The opposite of sympathetic joy is cynicism.
Mm.
Mudita literally is just joy. We translated as appreciative joy. How would you translate cynicism? Mudita.
Joy for others.
Joy for others. But it also can be joy for yourself, yeah? Because you joy your own good things as well.
I associate with rejoicing.
Rejoicing?
Sympathetic joy.
Sympathy sort of means a bit too close to compassion. That's what they used to use for it, but it's a bit kind of painful.
It doesn't mean close to, you know, you experience it as your own.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if it is your own.
Close feeling, yeah. Yeah. I think yes, the literal meaning of it is good, but I think it's a little bit confusing.
Mudita is nice. Everyone knows what you mean.
Like, sometimes they experience the joy of a mother or parents when the children are successful.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, a little bit tricky to translate it. In compassion, in here it translates altruistic joy, and it's translated arati as discontent, cynicism, arati, dissatisfaction, cynicism.
But cynicism is kind of twisted.
Well, cynicism always wants to see the bad in things, yeah. So when you're cynical, you never believe that anyone says anything good. So arati is delighting in the goodness. Upekkha, and the opposite of upekkha, interestingly enough, is patigha. Patigha is also a synonym of ill will, okay. And his Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as aversion, but more literally means resistance. Okay, the literal meaning of patigha is resistance. Okay, so you can see this actually translated as aversion is not incorrect, but it's a bit weird as why you would choose that. But when you understand it's resistance, then you understand that's why it's related with upekkha, because you're not resisting anything. It's coming and going, pleasant, unpleasant. It's coming in and out, and you're not resisting anything. So patigha, and I would translate it there as resistance. Asubhan, what? No, that's patibhaga. Yeah. It is the patibhaga, not the patigha. It's just the same as found in Patiga Sampasa, yeah. Yeah, it's more of a kind of technical psychobabble term. It's a kind of Buddhist psychobabble. It's patibhaga. It's literally counterpart. Patigha. Okay, develop asubha. When you develop asubha, then that gets rid of lust, raga. Develop anicca sanya, perception of impermanence. When you develop perception of impermanence, then asmimano,
the idea of self,
the conceit of self, asmi. We met up here before. The eso hamasmi, asmi, I am. The conceit, I am, will be abandoned.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that? When I read that before, I didn't understand how the perception of impermanence. Sorry, could you? What does that mean? That sentence in Pali?
When you develop perception of impermanence, then the conceit, I am, is abandoned.
So how is developing perception of impermanence rather than the perception of not me, not mine, as was mentioned before.
Anatta sanya, yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand the last sentence.
Yeah, all those things, like the three characteristics, are very closely related.
Yes, yes.
So if you develop one, of course you'll do any of them.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, so of course, yes, you can develop perception of not me, not mine, not myself, mm-hmm. to get rid of asmimana, but this is giving a practical meditation instruction. Okay, so often impermanence is more easy to get a handle of. Yeah, you can actually see it's more empirically straightforward to observe impermanence. Okay, and so as a meditation instruction, that makes sense. It's different from a philosophical point of view, then all of them are interrelated. But from a meditation instruction, often it's given in this way. Yeah, that's all. Okay, and then finally, the Buddha gets around to teaching anapanasati. Okay, now I'll just refer back to the earlier one. So he doesn't, Analia doesn't come to any great conclusions there as far as which one's more plausible, whether the four elements should be there or not. The Chinese version has, instead of the antidote of mudita, is an antidote of jealousy. So mudita versus jealousy, which is also pretty good, I think. Yeah, cynicism, jealousy, yeah. Dislike of somebody else's joy. And equanimity is an antidote to conceit, which is also not too bad. So anyway, but he, yeah, a bit of a discussion there. Okay, so sorry,
doesn't jealousy usually have a connotation of meaning that you want something that someone has?
Not necessarily, no. No.
That's, what's the word?
That's, covetousness.
Yes.
Covetousness, yeah, it's a specific form of jealousy, yeah.
Covetousness is a form of jealousy.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, the Chinese version's a bit different in that. In the Chinese version, the Buddha first spoke a verse of encouragement to Rahula and then left, and then Rahula later came back to see the Buddha and asked him about mindfulness of breathing some more. Okay. So, and there's some interesting differences in the explanation of mindfulness of breathing. Now, we are getting rather late, so I don't want to go on for too long. Yeah. Yeah, we will meet these teachings again. So that's not the only chance to do it. One point of interpretation here is whether what it says in front. I mentioned that before. Parimukhang sating upatpetwa. What does parimukha mean? Pari means round, okay? Mukha means the mouth or the face.
Or entrance.
Or entrance, or half a dozen other things. So parimukhang could mean just about anything. An expression which, according to the explanation given in the Vibhanga, it only occurs one time in the Vinaya, where it first refers to the group of six monks being prohibited to shave their beards, parimukhang. Okay? So you're not allowed to shave your beard so that it's just around your mouth. Okay, so in that context, it obviously means literally around your mouth. Okay? So then the question is, what does it mean in the context of meditation? An expression which, according to the explanation given in the Vibhanga of the Abhidhamma and the Patisamhita Magga, refers to the nostril area as the proper location for mindfulness of breathing. It is nasikage, it says in the Abhidhamma. This explanation finds support in the Ekotra Agama discourse, which explicitly speaks of keeping the mind at the tip of the nose. Alright? So, okay, so you understand the problem here? We have this word, parimukhang sating upatthapetva. One sits down, one parimukhang, one does meditation. And we don't know what parimukha means, right? We want to meditate, we want to know what the Buddha told us how to meditate. We don't know what this word means. And it could mean just about anything. Or nothing. Right? It might be just one of those words, you know, so often we find these words put in there which don't actually add anything to the meaning. They just sort of repeat what was said somewhere else, so you can drop it out or whatever, it doesn't change it. But maybe it doesn't, maybe this isn't one of those words. Maybe it really means something really, really important. And we're not going to get enlightened until we know what parimukha means. And we don't know until afterwards, and it's too late, and we're dead already. But how can I let go of my clinging unless I know what parimukha means? I'm desperate. I need to know. What is parimukham? And the Abhidhamma is our earliest source that defines it, and it says the tip of the nose. And not only is it found in Pali Abhidhamma, but it's confirmed in the Ekotara Agama Sutta itself. At the tip of the nose.
Well, the translator could have added that in.
The translator could well have added that in, yes, especially as the Ekotara Agama is quite late. So, is that what it means? At an earlier point, Maharahulavada Sutta used the same expression with establishing mindfulness in front. This was when Rahula sat down for meditation after receiving the Buddha's instructions on contemplation of the aggregates. Okay? In this context, one would, however, expect the injunction to keep mindfulness parimukhang to have a different meaning, since contemplation of the five aggregates does not bear any apparent relation to the tip of the nose. That's a very good point, isn't it? All the more so since Rahula still had yet to be given instructions on mindfulness of breathing.
He's only 18 years old and been around the Sangha for how long?
The Chinese version... Watch it. The Chinese version of this instance does in fact not mention the nose tip, but rather speaks simply of establishing one-pointedness of the mind. Okay? So, Pali gives the same thing. The Akotara Agama version gives two different renderings of what in the Pali is the same. Okay? Now, what does that mean? Does the Chinese translator, did he have two different terms there that he had to render? Probably not. We know that the Akotara Agama is very, very loose in its translation, okay, and very, very inaccurate and inconsistently translated. Yeah, it's a kind of hippie translation. They'd been taking a bit too much soma or something when they did that. It's out around here too.
Yeah,
that's good stuff. So that doesn't really, the fact that the Chinese translation does it in two different ways doesn't really prove anything, okay? The parimukha could mean around the mouth, around the face, in front or on top, and several other occurrences of parimukha have indeed little to do with the nose tip. Also talking about Brahma Viharas, which also has no relationship with the tip of the nose, but one still does the parimukha thing when doing Brahma Viharas. Okay, standard description for meditation in other Ekotra Agama discourses do in fact not speak of the nose tip, but consistently speak of putting mindfulness in the front. Okay, but maybe it's, so that it suggests that the explanation in the Chinese part here would rather be an explanatory gloss on the practice. Okay, so this is a suggestion we had earlier that the Chinese is the same. Now, yeah, well, that's kind of problematic. Now, so what's the answer? What does it mean? What does parimukhang mean? What do you actually do when you sit down to meditate?
I think it's like the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
This means
establish
awareness.
Just means establish awareness. It doesn't add anything to the meaning. Yeah, and notice that grammatically, of course, it could be interpreted in different ways because it's a parimukhang sateng. So these are both accusatives. So one establishes mindfulness at the parimukha, or it could mean one establishes parimukhang sateng. So it could be like an adjective thing. It's a kind of mindfulness which is parimukhang.
I think that's better.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, try not to keep you in suspense for too much longer. I did do a little bit of research on this little pointy point, and if this is a bit of a test to see who's been studying history of mindfulness. Four years of my life.
I have to find that in volume one.
Yes. And there's a Sanskrit variant reading which says something like pratimukhang, something like that. And pratimukhang means, one of the meanings of it is establishes. Okay? So in that sense, it's exactly the same. It is in fact a synonym for upatthapeti or upatthana. So it establishes an establishment of mindfulness, which doesn't really work in English, but of course we know that in Pali, that's exactly the kind of idiom that's used all the time. Okay, so this is what I think is that parimukhang doesn't mean anything, doesn't add anything to the meaning. It's merely repeating the same meaning as we have there. So it would be establishes an establishment of mindfulness. So all of that, come round to the end and say it doesn't actually say anything. This is why there are few people doing textual research into Buddhist studies. Yeah.
Why would you say the same thing twice?
For emphasis, Pali Suttas are constantly saying things twice, partly it's to reinforce against loss in the oral tradition, that you can lose or change one word. Now, if my suggestion is correct, and Parimukhang should in fact be Pratimukhang, then that would show that that principle works. You can actually change the word, and you still end up with the same meaning.
You know, some of these words, though, they sort of have their roots in, like, especially, they have their roots in physical realities. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's where they derive from.
Yeah.
So, just would make sense that it would be connected to a part of the body, even sort of, I don't know if this is the right way, but etymologically.
Yeah.
Like, that, you know, that have the heart base or things like that, they have physical.
It would if it was used for that specific meditation, but the problem is because it's used for basically any kind of meditation.
But it still could make sense if that could carry over quite easily.
Yeah, maybe.
It's just a dancer's point of view
that makes sense. It makes sense from a dancer's point of view, okay. So, yeah. I mean, certainly, yes, the point is true that meditation should be focused and body-centered. That's obviously correct. But whether that word means that or not, I have my doubts.
Like establishing concerned mind, you know, might derive from an experience of...
Right. So then we go through the 16 steps of Anapana. So I won't go through them right now. That would take a little bit too long to do in the immediate case. There are a few variations in the Chinese teaching on breath meditation here. Chinese has directed awareness to the temperature of in-breaths and out-breaths. Are they cool or warm? Okay. So that's quite interesting, because usually the out-breath is a little bit warmer than the in-breath. Yeah. The Chinese also has an instruction on whether the breath is present or not present. Okay. So again, that's also quite a meaningful instruction, because breath does tend to disappear when the body becomes very peaceful in meditation. Yeah. And the Chinese version also has become aware of the breath comes from the heart. Interesting, isn't it? And so here, actually this is quite interesting, it refers to... This instruction could imply that you become aware of the breath in the chest area at this point. Such a way of practice is known in the Thai tradition, where the point seems to be that after some initial practice of mindfulness of breathing at the nose tip in order to build up continuity of mindfulness, one shifts to focusing on the chest or heart area in order to further collect and concentrate the mind. So that's kind of interesting. Whether that's the case here or not is not certain. Okay. Now, that at the end of that, Venerable Rahula was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Whereas the Chinese version says that Rahula put the instructions into practice, developed four jhanas and the three higher knowledges, went to the presence of the Buddha and proclaimed his achievement, which the Buddha approved of, and then declared Rahula to be foremost among his disciples in observing the rules of training. While the Pali discourses agree on observation of the rules of training to be indeed and outstanding quality Rahula they associate his full awakening with another occasion. This occasion stands in close relation to the present discourse, as in as much as it's found in the Chula Rahulavada discourse, also found in the Majjhima Nikaya. According to that, in the Pali tradition, Rahula became an Arahant after receiving an instruction by the Buddha concerned with the true nature of the six sense spheres.
Isn't he foremost in desirous of training?
Being desirous of training, yeah.
Not upholding rules or following rules?
Oh, it's probably just a translation phrasing, yeah. So again, as we've noticed so many times, that the doctrinal portions of the suttas are basically the same, but things like especially the attainments mentioned in the suttas are not at all congruent and may be completely different in different versions. Okay. So sorry not to have time to do the breath meditation, but we will meet that in other suttas. I think we already have met it in some suttas, and we'll meet it in other suttas, so we'll have a chance to discuss that on another occasion. Okay. Any more questions before we break up? Let's finish by paying respects.